the Lord said, judge not, that ye be not judged. And James also repeats the warning. We're so hasty to pronounce judgment on one another, but James says the judge stands before the door. And therefore, we shouldn't be grudging against each other. Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you who judge your neighbor? And this is what Job is saying to his friends. Stop judging me. Stop condemning me. And Zophar felt very hurt at this. Chapter 20. Then Zophar the Naamathite answered, therefore my disquieting thoughts make me respond, even because of my inward agitation. I listened to the reproof which insults me, and the spirit of my understanding makes me answer. Do you know this from of old, from the establishment of man on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless momentary? So it is the same repetition, the same accusation being trotted out in other words. It's true, David says, I've seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree, yet he passed away and he could not be found. Zophar said in verse 6, though his loftiness reaches the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he perishes forever like his refuse. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? He may be referring to the revolt of Satan, whose loftiness, who wanted to set his throne above the heavens. Remember, that was Lucifer's desire, that he should be like the Most High, that he should be the highest. But he says, although the wicked man metaphorically reaches the heaven for loftiness and his head touches the cloud, he perishes forever like his refuse. It literally happened with Jezebel. God pronounced sentence on Jezebel and he said, Jezebel will be eaten by the dogs. And so nobody will be able to point to her corpse and say, this is Jezebel. He perishes forever. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? He flies away like a dream and they cannot find him. Even like a vision of the night, he is chased away. There's a picture of the ungodly just disappearing like a dream. Sometimes we're very glad to wake up and find out that it was only a dream and that the morning brings with it better things than we were dreaming about. Sometimes not so much. It can be the other way around. One of the speakers I heard said that his little boy woke up in the morning and was crying his eyes out. And his mother wanted to know what was the problem. He said, well, I dreamt that I found a quarter on the ground. So I picked it up and I closed my fist around it. And to make sure I wouldn't lose it, I stuck my fist under my pillow. He said, when I got up in the morning, I pulled out my hand and there was nothing in my hand. He was brokenhearted because he'd lost the little treasure he thought that he'd found. It was only a dream. And in the same way, here we read about the wicked, that they fly away like a dream, like a vision of the night. He is chased away. He is the eye which saw him, sees him no more, and his place no longer beholds him. Moses, also in one of the Psalms, he says, our life is soon cut off, and we fly away like a dream. In the 90th Psalm, this is how he puts it. Verse 5, thou hast swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. In the morning, they are like grass, which sprouts anew. In the morning, it flourishes and sprouts anew. Towards evening, it fades and withers away. he talks about verse 10. He says, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. Just like that, like a watch in the night, or like a dream. His sons, says Zophar, favor the poor, and his hands give back his wealth. There's also retribution here. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, we're in verse 12, and he hides it under his tongue, though he desires it, and will not let it go, but holds it in his mouth, yet his food in his stomach is changed to the venom of cobras within him. Then in verse 18 he spoke about retribution. He returns what he has attained and cannot swallow it. As to the riches of his trading, he cannot even enjoy them. He had to give them back, for he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has seized a house which he has not built. Over and again, there's this accusation that Job must have done something like this to experience the misery that he was undergoing. Because he knew no quiet within him, he does not retain anything he desires. Solomon in Ecclesiastes mentions the case of a person who seems to have everything and yet has nothing. And this is how he puts it. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. This is the fate of a wicked rich man, says Zophar. And he's obviously drawing a parallel between that case and Job. He says that prosperity of fools destroys them. In verse 22, in the fullness of his plenty, he will be cramped. The hand of everyone who suffers will come against him. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him and will rain it on him while he is eating. Again, we have an example of that in the case of the people of Israel who had come out of Egypt. They wanted flesh to eat. So God gave them flesh to eat until, he said, not just a day or 2 days or a week, but a whole month, until it's coming out of your ears, out of your nostrils. Well, God sent quails. They gathered the quails and they cured them. Then they settled down to a big feast. But the Bible tells us that while they were eating, God smote them with a plague for their greed. And this is what Zophar is saying here. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him and will rain it on him while he is eating. Verse 27, the heavens will reveal his iniquity and the earth will rise up against him. And he ends his blast against Job in verse 29 by saying, this is the wicked man's portion from God, even the heritage decreed to him by God. Well, he really got back at Job. And now Job, in response. Chapter 21. Then Job answered, listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your way of consolation. Console me, he says. If you're not going to console me by kind words, at least console me this way, by hearing me out. That's what he means here. Listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your way of consolation. It's a good advice, good to be a good listener. And then after that, says Job, you may scoff if you please. Bear with me that I may speak, then after I have spoken, you may mock. My problem, said Job, is that it's not merely a human dispute. If it was a merely human dispute, that would give me enough cause to be agitated. But how much more when my dispute is with God, and I can't even speak to God face to face. So here I am carrying on a one-sided complaint, and I don't even know if God is listening to me or whether he's going to respond to me. Verse 4, as for me is my complaint to man, and why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished, and put your hand over your mouth. To put the hand over the mouth is a sign of astonishment. When people are at a loss for words, the Bible speaks of it as putting their hand to their mouth. Also, it's to restrain any uncomely speech that they do it. Then he says, you've been speaking, Zophar, about the fate of a wicked man, that the eye which saw him sees him no more, his place no longer beholds him. He will not have any quiet within him. He does not retain anything he desires. Nothing remains for him to devour. His prosperity does not endure. Let me tell you something, says Job. Its opposite is often the opposite way around. Verse 7, why do the wicked still live, continue on, also become very powerful? Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, neither is the rod of God on them. Unlike me or my children, their houses are safe from fear, mine has not been. The rod of God is not on them, it has certainly been on me. Their descendants are established with them in their sight, their offspring before their eyes, not with me. My children have been snatched away by death. His ox mates without fail, his cow calves and does not abort. Everything seems to be going well for the wicked. Too often, says Job, they send forth their little ones like the flock, their children skip about, they sing to the timbrel and harp, and rejoice at the sound of the flute. They have a very easy life and a very peaceful death, he says. They spend their days in prosperity and suddenly they go down to Sheol. Their death is very easy, it's very quick, it's not a long, lingering, painful thing. They have a very happy life and they say, that's all I ever wanted. So I've had all that I need and now farewell, sweet life. And they just give up. And that's the end of them. He says, this is what happens so often with the wicked people. And the result is, because everything is going well with them, they don't care for God at all. They don't feel their need of God. Verse 14, and they say to God, depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of thy ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him? The whole perspective is a material one. It doesn't enter their minds that they owe God, they owe themselves and what they have to God. And that God has supreme and absolute claim over every human being because he is our creator. But they only want to serve God if they can get something out of it. This is the hireling mentality. The servant mentality. They don't care about God. They don't realize that all the good things they had in this life were due to God, and that it was his goodness that was calling them to himself. They didn't even think about it. They were quite mercenary about it. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him? Now let's put it the other way around. We serve God not for gain, although God is good and he does give us what we need. But even if he hadn't, our duty would still be to serve him. That's really what the word of God is saying here, that he has absolute claim over us, whatever he gives us or whatever he withholds from us. But thank God we do know that he doesn't withhold anything good from us. You've heard of Arminians and Calvinists, haven't you? This is the kind of theological battle that goes on in every Bible school. Those that are for sovereign grace and those who are for free will, and there are pros and cons all the time. Well, what does What about this scripture, says one side. And another side says, well, what about that one? The debate continues to rage. Well, there was a young man who was being ordained for the Presbyterian ministry. And that he had to come for his final interview before the board. And there was an old man there who was a hyper-Calvinist. And he said, young man, are you prepared to be damned for the glory of God? This young budding minister hesitated. And then he said, yes, I'm quite ready. In fact, I'm quite ready for the whole board to be damned for the glory of God. And he put that old man in his place. Stupid. It's carrying things too far. Well, I don't know if he got license or not, but that was a worthy reply. They say to God, depart from us, we do not even desire the knowledge of thy ways. What would we gain if we entreat him? The point is that God made us for himself. And he is displeased when we don't entreat him, when we don't seek his face, when we don't seek to serve him. Job says about them, behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Their prosperity is not in their hand. They think that they've got all this by themselves. No, it isn't. God has put it into their hands. And therefore, the counsel of the wicked is far from me. I don't want anything to do with that kind of mercenary attitude. So Zophar has got Job to say this. I am not serving God for what he gives me. He has taken it all away from me, and I can still say, I'm going to serve him. Though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. And although I may argue with him, one thing is sure, I will not give up owning him for my God. So little by little, he's clearing away the cobwebs. He's being compelled to do it. Verse 17, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? Are they as straw before the wind, and like chaff which the storm carries away? Is it so all the time? He's challenging that premise. You say, God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. Let God repay him so that he may know it. And so on. But he says in verse 21, for what does he care for his household after him when the number of his months is cut off? No, says Job, there are both kinds. There are those who live a happy and peaceful life, and people look at them and they say, what's the use of serving God? Look at this person. He doesn't give a thought to God, and look how well he's doing. But then he says, there are others who are quite the opposite case. So it's not black and white. This is a gray area. Sin has complicated this world. Sin has complicated providence, circumstances. You and I cannot say this is black and this is white. We can't say because someone is prospering that God is on their side. It might well be that God is allowing them to prosper and to ruin themselves that way, as one of the Psalms puts it, Psalm 73. And there's another case where God certainly brings retribution on the wicked person and makes him an example to others. Here's how he puts it, verse 23 to 26. One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied. His sides are filled out with fat, and the marrow of his bones is moist, while another dies with a bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. Together they lie down in the dust, and worms cover them. We don't get all our answers in this life. And then he turned to his friends and he says, I know what you're hinting at. Verse 27, behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me. For you say, where is the household of the nobleman? And where is the tent, the dwelling places of the wicked? Aren't you suffering the same fate as the dwelling places of the wicked? Where's your house? That big house in which your children were feasting has been blown to the ground. But then he says, although not all scores are settled in this life, there is a day of judgment coming. Verse 29, have you not asked wayfaring men, and do you not recognize their witness? Investigate. Even people who are travelers, traveling by, will tell you what is so clear and plain, that for the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. They will be led forth at the day of fury. Who will confront him with his actions, and who will repay him for what he has done? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. Moreover, all men will follow after him, while countless ones go before him. Nobody in this life may confront the wicked man. He's buried with full honors. But there's a day coming, the day of fury, he calls it here, the day of calamity, and they're being reserved for that. In Psalm 73, Asaph says, I realize now what you're doing when you allow the wicked to prosper. They won't have you. They want just the good things of this life. So he says to God, you give them everything, and the result is they want you even less. And so by giving them what they want, you are making them destroy themselves. That's what God does many times. It's a terrible thing when God leaves us alone. Sometimes we resent the fact that God steps into our lives and our circumstances and does something uncomfortable to us. But thank God for those interferences, those heavenly interferences, so called, because it shows God is interested in us. The worst thing that can happen to anyone is for God to lead them to the hardness of their own heart and to their own way, because then they're sure to destroy themselves. Well, he says at the end, in verse 34, how then will you vainly comfort me, for your answers remain full of falsehood? That ends the second round of talks. And now in the third round, we find that Eliphaz has his opportunity, and it looks as though Bildad is just about to launch another of his long-winded statements, but Job cuts him short. We come to the third round of talks, and we start again with Eliphaz, his third and his last try. Chapter 22. Then Eliphaz the Temanite responded, can a vigorous man be of use to God, or a wise man be useful to himself? Is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous, or profit if you make your ways perfect? Do you think that you are benefiting God by being righteous, or if you make your ways perfect? Do you think you really add anything to God? What he's really saying here is a truth that is known, that we really can't affect God for better or for worse. God is beyond reach. We can't add anything to him. Although it is true, in another sense, that it is pleasure to the Almighty when we are righteous. It is his will that we should behave ourselves righteously, that we should walk in the paths of righteousness. He leads us in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake, and he is pleased. But the benefit is all ours. He says in verse 4 to Job, is it because of your reverence that he reproves you, that he enters into judgment against you? Now, seeing that he can't get through to Job, he launches into a full-scale accusation. They couldn't find an answer, so all they did was to condemn. It's a very cheap trick to get out of a tight corner. Job steadfastly refused to acknowledge guilt. And they tried, without success, to lay guilt trips on him. It didn't work, so now they openly accuse. The things that he says here are quite false. Verse 5, "Is not your wickedness great and your iniquities without end?" That was not true. "For you have taken pledges of your brothers without cause and stripped men naked." That was not true either. The pledge was a kind of a garment. In that part of the world, men had an inner robe which was very much like a long nightshirt reaching down to the ankles. And then the outer garment was a kind of a robe. The Lord wore one of those. Those were called pledges. If a man wanted to borrow some money or an article, and he was asked to give a pledge, in Bible times he commonly took off his outer coat and said, "Here, here's my pledge." The law of Moses said that at night time the creditor was to give him back his pledge so that he could wrap himself in it, because the poor people had nothing else to sleep in. That was their blanket. In that part of the world, you don't need blankets. You just need a little something to wrap yourself in, because it's warm, even at night. So when he says, "You have taken pledges of your brothers without cause and stripped men naked," what he's really saying is, you've taken those cloaks that they give for pledge, but without cause. They didn't owe you anything. You just grabbed their coats from them, and you had no right to do so, no cause to do so. You left them naked. Well, the term naked is comparative. Anything that's less than fully clothed is called naked. Like Isaiah. Isaiah was told to take the sackcloth from off his loins and the shoes from off his foot, and he walked naked and barefoot before the Lord for 2 years. Well, no way was he walking around in his birthday suit for 2 years. No, what it was meant is that he was not fully clothed any longer. So this is the sense in which it's taken here. Then Eliphaz went on to say in verse 7, "To the weary you have given no water to drink, and from the hungry you have withheld bread." Job is going to answer all those accusations in full. "But the earth belongs to the mighty man, and the honorable man dwells in it." If you are really an honorable man, then you would also have a share. The earth, though, has been given to those who are better than you. "You have sent widows away empty, and the strength of the orphans has been crushed. Therefore, snares surround you, and sudden dread terrifies you, or darkness so that you cannot see, and an abundance of water covers you." You're overwhelmed with all kinds of affliction, dread, suffering, darkness. Judge through the thick darkness. Again, he's accusing Job of saying, "Oh, God is not seeing what I'm doing, therefore I can be as wicked as I like. God can't see." That again was a false accusation, because Job himself had said earlier on, "I realize that his eyes are upon me, he's trying me, he's watching my every move." Verse 15, "Will you keep to the ancient path which wicked men have trod, who were snatched away before their time, whose foundations were washed away by a river? They said to God, 'Depart from us,' and what can the Almighty do to them? Yet he filled their houses with good things, but the counsel of the wicked is far from me." "Why do you follow these old wicked ways, Job?" says Eliphaz. "Don't you realize these men were snatched away before their time, and their foundations were washed away by a river?" Doesn't that remind you of the two houses the Lord Jesus spoke about? The foolish man built his house upon the sand, and the floods came and the winds blew and the waters beat upon that house and it fell because it was founded upon the sand and its fall was great. That's what he's speaking of here. Their foundations were washed away by a river. But no, says Eliphaz, as for me, I'm not going to follow your bad example, Job. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Then he followed it with some advice for Job. Verse 21, yield now and be at peace with him. Thereby good will come to you. He was presupposing that Job was not at peace with God and that he was not yielded to God. But the advice in itself is a good one. Yield now and be at peace with him, thereby good will come to you. Please receive instruction from his mouth and establish his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. If you remove unrighteousness far from your tent, etc., etc., then, verse 26, you will delight in the Almighty and lift up your face to God. How can we check ourselves? How can we examine ourselves and find out whether we are really delighting ourselves in God? The recipe is quite simple. Make our peace with God, submit to him, receive his word into our hearts, not just into our heads, but in our hearts, and seek to obey him. Live a new life of obedience. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. If you remove unrighteousness far from your tent, then you will delight in the Almighty and lift up your face to God. There's also a promise for such people that they will be a benefit to others. He says you won't only benefit yourself, but you will also be a help to others. Verse 27, you will pray to him and he will hear you, and you will pay your vows. You will also decree a thing and it will be established for you, and light will shine on your ways. When you are cast down, you will speak with confidence, and the humble person he will save. Verse 29 is literally, he will deliver the island of... verse 29. When men are cast down, you will say there is lifting up. That's literally. In the New American Standard, when you are cast down, you will speak with confidence. But the Hebrew says, when men are cast down, you will be able to bring a word of encouragement that will lift them up onto their feet again. And the humble person, he will save. So, through your influence, through your prayers, you'll not only save yourself, but you'll be able to be a help to others who are cast down, who are in trouble, who are in need. He will deliver one who is not innocent, and he will be delivered through the cleanness of your hands. That's marvelous. I don't know why the translation says he will deliver one who is not innocent. Literally, he will deliver the island of the innocent, and it is delivered through the cleanness of your hands. When you and I walk with God, we bring a blessing on people around us. Joseph was like that. His master saw that God made everything to prosper in his hand. Jacob was like that. His uncle said to him, I have learned from experience that God has blessed me for your sake. And so we find that many times in the history of Israel, it was for the sake of the few that were obeying God that God spared the many. You'll find that at the end of Isaiah. Isaiah 65 verse 8. Thus says the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one says, do not destroy it, for there is benefit in it, so I will act on behalf of my servants in order not to destroy all of them. What he's saying here is, most of my people that I'm speaking to have departed from me, they have committed idolatry. But there are a few that are still my servants. And therefore, I will spare the whole nation for their sakes. Elijah said the same thing. He pleaded with God against Israel, and God says, wait a minute, Elijah. I've got 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal, and that's why I won't destroy the nation. For their sakes, I spare the nation. You and I have a sacred task in this world to be as godly as we can, or to be as to walk as closely to God as we can, because in doing so, we shall not only benefit ourselves, but those amongst whom we live, our society. We'll do good to our country. We'll hold off God's judgment on our society. Paul said to Timothy, take heed unto thyself and to the doctrine, to the life as well as to the teaching. For in so doing thou shalt both save thyself and them that hear thee.